Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
I don't know if any of you guys log into my favorite website. It's a beacon of hope and optimism. It's called Forbes.com. the latest look at Forbes.com, and they have a special section in that called ForbesBillionaires.com. For some interesting reason, they always put out their billionaires list on International Women's Day. I don't know the connection because there are very few women on the list, but maybe they're being respectful. The latest list tells us that there are 55 Indian dollar billionaires, okay, whose net asset worth is equal to the current Indian budget's entire expenditure outlay for 1.21 billion people. A 10% return on their net asset worth would finance our health, higher education, rural employment, and handlooms and textiles budget for as long as the banks last, and as long as the banks remain solvent. That incidentally places us number 4 or 5 in the world's list of billionaires. There are a few poseurs or pretenders above us, but we're not talking about the first place. Everyone knows who the 800-pound gorilla on that list is. But the Russians and Chinese are technically above us in the numbers of billionaires. The Chinese billionaires are little leaguers. Their net asset worth is a piffling $2 billion apiece, as against $4.5 billion for our guys. Ours used to be $6.5 billion before the jerks on Wall Street blew it for everybody in 2008. And as for the Russians, you know, I mean, there is our obvious moral superiority. Every 5 years, they send half their billionaires to prison. We send ours to parliament. Now, 15 years ago, there wasn't a single dollar billionaire in India. These 55 individuals, their net asset worth is equivalent to 1/5 or 1/6 of the gross domestic product of a nation growing at 9%, whose economy is growing at 9%, a nation of 1.21 billion people. 1/6 of the equivalent of the GDP is in the hands of 55 individuals. Now, in the time it took us to build a list of 55 dollar billionaires from zero, in a quarter of that time, in the last 4 years, 3 officially constituted committees of the government of India, on one of which I was a member for my sins, have all 3 told the government that it has to revise its rural poverty figures upwards and very high, much higher than it today publishes. Now, what's important is that all these 3 committees are officially constituted. You might wonder why a government needs to have 3 committees or 4 committees on the same subject in less than 5 years. There's a very sound reason for that. The typical Indian method is to have go up to 15 committees on the same subject until one of them gives you the report you want. On farm suicides in the worst affected state of Maharashtra, there have been 13 inquiry commissions. The last one wrote a lot more about me than about farm suicides, and I'm honored, but that was the one at which they stopped because it said what they wanted. So we've had 3 commissions. One was the National Commission for Enterprises in the Unorganized Sector, available online, the first page of which tells you that in the nation of 55 billionaires, the first page tells you 836 million Indians live on less than 50 cents US a day, 20 rupees a day or less. That is the first paragraph of their report. That's also available online. The second, outraged by this, they set up a second commission called the BPL Expert Group. The BPL stands for Below Poverty Line. I was one of the members of the BPL Expert Group whose job was to bring down the figure. I mean, that's why they set us up. The experts, all of us experts, had some scintillating discussions, one of which consisted of 17 guys, all male, all upper class, 95% upper caste, debating furiously for 3 hours whether women were poor. There wasn't a single woman within a mile of the discussion. You'll be glad to know that we finally decided that on the whole, you are. Because allocations and quotas and subsidies are related to what we decide. Right? The third commission, but it still brought it, it brought it down to 50% of the population, and therefore the biggest annexure to the report is my dissent note, which agrees with the first commission. Then they brought a third commission. They were sick and tired of having 17 people and 15 people. They decided a one-man commission is better to handle. So they gave it to a very respectable neoliberal, Dr. Suresh Tendulkar, who brought it down, but still his figure is 12 to 14% higher than the official figure of the government of India. So all the commissions they have set up in 4 years show that rural poverty has, you know, the numbers are much higher than what was stated, while we have 55 billionaires. In the same period that we built the list of 55 billionaires, India sank every year in the United Nations Human Development Index till 2010, when the methodology, when the entire index has changed from the HDI to the Multidimensional Poverty Index. So we were at the, in around 2000, we were number 124 in the Human Development Index. By 2009, we were 134, but we had 55 billionaires. In the same period, IFPRI, which is the International Food and Policy Research Institute of DC, it puts out an index called the Global Hunger Index, listing the 85 hungriest nations in the world in descending order. India has steadily descended down that list to 67 out of 84. Most of the Latin American countries are ahead of us. All those Latin American countries together do not have the number of billionaires that we do. Incidentally, all the Scandinavian Nordic countries put together do not have a third of our billionaires, or maybe less than half, certainly. They, by the way, are usually the countries that top the list in the Human Development Index. In the same period that this happened, that the the hunger grew and the billionaires increased, we also had and continue to have the largest agrarian crisis in our history since the eve of the Green Revolution. It's a crisis completely driven by policy, not by natural calamity, not by drought, not by tsunami, but by economic policy. A whole raft of policies let loose in the early 90s have taken a deadly toll. If we look, and the farm suicides, I believe some of you have seen Nero's Guess, which is a documentary on inequality in India, which also looks at the farm crisis through my work. The farm suicides are not the farm crisis. They are its outcome, not its origin. They are its consequence, not its cause. And they are, since 1995, about a quarter of a million. Since the film came out, in the film you probably saw a figure of 200,000. Since then we have access to more data. All of this is official data. Suicide data, whether farmers or students or engineers or anyone else, is collected by the same agency. It's collated by an agency called the National Crime Records Bureau. In India, the Crime Bureau collects suicide statistics. Suicide is a crime. You commit it and we'll teach you never to do it again. Now, we have clear data from 97 to 2009, which tells us that 216,500 farmers have committed suicide, which is, incidentally, the largest recorded wave of suicides in human history. They may have been bigger, but they're not recorded. This is recorded by a government, and which has every interest in lowering the figures, and indeed, the figures are gross underestimates. Women farmers are largely excluded, for instance, and many other categories also. The second part of it is that if we take the figures from 1995-96, there are 2 years for which the data are incomplete, meaning many states did not enter their data when the system was new. However, I figure that if you are recorded in those years, you're just as dead, officially. If we add those, it crosses 240,000. If we take the 2010 figure, which will only come out in the last week of December, it will come out officially in January, but we will publish it in December. Then even if we take that at the low end of the average, then it crosses a quarter of a million. That's a quarter of a million suicides in one occupation, concentrated in five states, in five large states. And how do we know if it's getting better or it's worse? If we take the 13 years of CLEAR data, divide it into first 7 years and second 6 years, the annual average rates of the second 6 years are desperately worse than the first 7 years. So we take the second 6 years, or we take the latest year, for instance, 2009, 17,368, according to the Government of India. You're talking on average about one farmer committing suicide every 30 minutes. That's the national average. Now, how are the farmers' suicides different from those of other communities? Because we have farm population totals till 2001, the figures are going to get a lot worse now that the new census is out. Sometime next year, we'll get the farm population totals and we will know exactly how bad it is in terms of ratios. Now, what does this mean? It means if we take suicides in the population as a whole, they went up 15% between 1999 and 2009. That's actually a decline in the rate of suicides, because when the suicides went up 15% totally, the population went up 18% in the same decade. So in real terms, the rate at which suicides are being committed in the general population, which includes farmers, are falling. But if we separate farmers, then farm suicides are occurring at more than double the rate of non-farmers. Right? In those five states, the rise in percentage of farmer suicides is 53% across the decade. And this includes the richest state in the country, with the largest number of billionaires, Mumbai as capital, home to the Mumbai Stock Exchange, home to the sixth richest man in the world. His name is Mukesh Ambani. Mukesh and I share the same city. I've got about 620 square feet. He's got about twice that many acres. But we live technically, both of us, in Mumbai. He has just completed, or is still in the process of completing, building the costliest residence in history. It's somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion, and so far has a modest three helipads. It's got 27 floors, but built to a height of 60, so that each floor — he likes space — so each floor is about 20 feet high, and each floor is done in a different style. One is done in old Baroque, one is a Rajasthani Haveli, and so on. One is, of course, just for the cars. The Lexuses and the Mercedes and stuff. In the same period — now this is a table from the latest Indian budget document. There are two documents that the Government of India presents to you at budget time. One is called Economic Survey of India. One is called the Economic Survey of India, which is given to you just before the budget, and you can see what it's about. It's about the net availability of cereals and pulses to the Indian population. Everyone know what pulses are? I find that people — lentils. Okay, lentils. That's a major source of protein for the Indian population. Now, you have the data from the Government of India. The table is, for those who want to look at it, it's online. And we are looking at it right now online. And this is the economic survey statement that the Government of India places just before it introduces the budget. We have the data from 1951. Let's look at the last 5 years for which data is available. How is per capita availability of food grain calculated? Total food production minus wastage, which in India's case is 10% officially, much higher unofficially, minus wastage, minus exports, minus seed and feed, where the farmer retains grain, plus imports and plus available stocks of grain in the godowns. That figure divided by the population gives you one of the most abysmal figures worldwide. If you look at the last column, last five figures, 444, 436, 422.4, the average of those last 5 years comes to 436 grams per Indian. Now, that's a notional figure. Every Indian does not get, I mean, some of us get 3,000 grams a day. Most of us in the top 10% consume more than that. But what's important is that it's declining in every quarter of the reforms period since 91, ever since the neoliberal reforms begin. It's declining with every quarter. I'm not taking one-year one-off figures. I'm giving you five-year averages. You want to know how bad the decline is? It's worse than it was 50 years ago. Okay. Now, the average for 2005 to 2009 comes to 436, right? Now, you go up to the top and look at 1955 to 59, the average is 444, which in real terms is about 3 million tons of grain more available. Now, at this point, this is usually the point at which a very wounded Indian asks me, but hasn't it got to do with population growth? It doesn't. You can very easily correlate the growth rate of population with the growth rate of food grain production. When it was higher, when the food grain availability was higher in 55 to 59, the population growth rate was more than double what it is today. It was 3.5 to 3.7% annually. In the latest census, it's 1.76% annually, 17% decadally. Okay? So you're looking at the population growth rate has declined by half, but the food grain production has plummeted even further. So what it means is that the growth rate of food grain production has collapsed. There were many reasons for that. And why so? Incidentally, hunger amongst Indian children, according to the Government of India's National Family Health Survey, 46% of Indian children are malnourished, 46%, which is very much higher than the sub-Saharan average, which is between 32 and 35% for the countries of sub-Saharan Africa. Ethiopia, for instance, has 38%. All those are United Nations HDI figures. India has 46%. Right? Again, those are underestimates, but they are government figures. It's also important that these sub-Saharan African countries, and many of in the old HDI up to 2009, there is not a single Latin American country below us on any of these measures, including Bolivia, which is 11 positions above us in the old 2009 HDI. What's important is that about 80 nations which are above us, not one of them has 9% growth. Not one of them is the fourth largest military power in the world. Not one of them is the world's sixth or seventh nuclear power. Not one of them, maybe with the exception of Brazil, is a software superpower. So a country with all these decided advantages is increasing the number of hungry steadily. Right? So you have an acute growth of hunger in this case. By the way, if you look at those columns, they are a mixture of cereals plus pulses. The last column is cereals plus pulses. Pulses, which are a major source of protein, very major source of protein for the poor, have fallen by half. If you take the 1955 to 59 average, the average for pulses is about 70 grams. If you take the 2005 to 2009 average, it's about 35 grams. So the this is not even consumption, this is availability. It's notional. It's what is theoretically available per Indian. Now, if you look at the start of the reforms, that was when we had reached our highest ever figure our best figure ever in 1991, which is 510 grams, and before that 476, not so bad. The year it's 510 grams is when we start the reforms, and now it's 436. That is not a fall. It is not a fall of 74 grams. It's a fall of 74 grams into 365 days into 1.21 billion Indians, which is, I don't know, somewhere between 25 and 30, 32 million tons. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is that in this entire period, you have an astonishing growth of inequality. It's grown faster in the last 15 years than at any time in the last 50 years and makes a fair bit to assault colonial period records now. At no point in our history has, if you look at 1950 to 80s, inequality in incomes, for instance, actually declines. Marginally, slowly, but it declines. From the 90s, it's shooting up dramatically, and there is not a measure in which you can't see it. Now, if you take the last 5 years, those 5 years when the food grain intake, when the food grain availability is the lowest, there are two things that you have to bear in mind. Those are the 5 years of the highest price rise in Indian history across a five-year period. Okay? If you take one-off years, then 1973-74 saw worse price rises, which also led towards the emergency and everything else. But the last 5 years are our worst period in history in terms of price rise. Two snapshots on the contrast. Despite having the worst price, despite having the lowest availability per Indian of food grain, there's more than 50 million tons of food grain lying in the godowns rotting. The Supreme Court of India has ordered the government of India to distribute that grain amongst the hungry poor, and the government has told the Supreme Court to FO. It's a policy decision, which I'm very grateful to them for clarifying, because it's a policy decision that people should stop. Now, why is it on such a low availability of food grain per capita, there is a seeming surplus? The surplus is a surplus of hunger. You can't buy it. There's no purchasing power. It's the highest period of price rise in our history as an independent nation. So that's one way in which you can look at the sheer inequality of it. The top 10% are eating better than they have ever done before in history. I'll give you two more snapshots. One is, I guess some of you have heard of our proud achievement, the cheapest car in the world, Nano. Have you? The Tata Nano. Okay. The Nano is also the cheapest car in the world because it's the most highly subsidized car in the world. More than half its market price comes from public subsidies. Yes. It went to Bengal. It got 6,000 crores, 60,000 million in subsidies to set up its plant there. It pulled out there without producing a single machine. Went to Gujarat, where it got 30,000 crores, that's about $7 billion in subsidy. And even if you calculate, it's putting out about 50,000 vehicles a year. More than half the market price is subsidized by public tax dollars. But the more important thing was, in 2009, Nano rolled out its first edition to Ace and handed over the keys to a citizen. I was present that day in Bangalore when the first the first owner of Nano got his keys. There were two headlines on the front page. One said, world's cheapest car rolls out. The guy who made the page either had a devious sense of humor or missed the irony. The parallel headline was, the costliest lentils in history. Okay, the cheapest car and the costliest lentils in history at 104 rupees a kilogram for tuvar dal, which is red gram, I think. Tuvar dal is red gram, right? So you have that. I do an exercise every quarter in my building. The woman who comes to clean our flat, she services 10 flats in our building. She's a farmer. She comes from a rural area called Raigad, and each harvest, she brings my wife and me a few kilograms of her harvest. But agriculture having tanked, she can't support herself, right? She cannot support herself. The family cannot sustain on it. Had they come four decades ago, they would have been working class or lower middle class, because the mills were open, the factories were open, the industries were thriving, they would have got jobs, their children would have gone to school. Today, she can only be a domestic servant. What I do is every 3 months, I do her cost of living index and I do my cost of living index. And I find that over 15 years, absolutely everything that is convenient and matters to me has become much cheaper and much more accessible. For us, India is shining. I'll give you an example. For when I bought my first computer in 1991, it was a PC-80. And the whole building assembled to see it, because it was so sexy, it had a 20 megabyte hard disk. It cost 52,000 rupees. At a fraction of that price, my cell phone is about 200 times more powerful than it is. Than that machine was. In 1984, when the Bhopal gas tragedy occurred, we spent 6 hours debating on whether to send the reporter by plane or by train. finally we compromised. We said we have a correspondent there. So what we're going to do is we're going to send the photographer by plane and the reporter by train to back up the other car. Because plane tickets were, I don't know how many plane journeys I've done last year. Maybe 40, maybe 50. In 1989, all of us journalists sat on strike outside the Indian Express office. Because our newspaper had caved in on our demand, but the Express has always held out. The demand was 250 rupees more. How many dollars is that? $6? $6 for transport allowance. As I now recall, all the strikers sitting on that strike, today own cars given to them by the newspaper, with allowances for drivers, including me. So one section of the population has gained incredibly. But back to farming and snapshots, two snapshots on debt, and you know, we can discuss it from there. What's happened is that you've had a gigantic withdrawal, or the inequality has sharpened and deepened so dramatically. This snapshot should capture it for you. Apart from the Indians here, I don't know how many of you have heard of a town called Aurangabad. Aurangabad is part of a region called Marathwada, one of the poorest regions in the rich state of Maharashtra. The Marathwada region, its per capita income, the per capita income of the Marathwada region is lower than the national average, substantially, and much lower than the average of Maharashtra state, which is the richest state in the country, unless you want to count small ones like Haryana, but it's not half as rich as Maharashtra in other ways. So we are talking about a region with a very low per capita income, but such concentration of wealth in the last 15 years that a small group of businessmen, a very small group of businessmen, are about to walk into the Guinness Book of Records for making the biggest ever buy of Mercedes Benzes, 150 at one shot, which now has irritated their rival town of Kolhapur in western Maharashtra, who are negotiating 150 BMWs. I'm afraid I sort of screwed up the deal by writing about where the money came from and what was the interest rate. Now, the deal was, they got a huge discount. When you buy 150, you can ask for a discount. And it cost about 640 million rupees. It's about $12.5 million. Out of the $12.5 million, I mean, there are very different categories of vehicles. Apparently, there are many gradations of luxury, I was not aware of, but I think there's one which has a sauna in it or whatever, but you know, there are many categories of luxury in the Mercedes. In that, of the $12 million that it cost, 10 million came from a public sector bank, the largest public sector bank of India and the largest bank in the world in terms of number of branches, State Bank of India. A public sector bank mandated by law to lend at cheap rates to poor people, to farmers, to workers, to poor women, gave them this $10 million at 7% interest. Right? 7% interest. Now, if you're a farmer in Marathwada buying a tractor through the same bank, the interest rate is 14%. A tractor. Productive expenditure. If you're a poor woman in the villages of Marathwada getting money which may have originated from this bank but which comes through that, excuse the expletives deleted, comes through that highly romanticized thing, nonsense called microfinance, then you're paying 36% interest on a loan of $150 to $200, your interest rate is 36. It could be higher. Sometimes it's concealed. They say 24%, but by the time the poor woman in the village accesses it, it's 36%. Now look at it. A businessman getting a Mercedes-Benz from a public sector bank, 7% interest. A farmer buying a tractor from the same bank, I mean, through the same bank's financing, 14% interest. Starts at 12.75, depends on how much you take, but it's 14% average. Poor woman taking a loan of $200, 36% interest. That's welcome to India 2011. That's the poorer you are, the more productive you are, the more you're going to be punished for it. Right. In this situation, in the last 20 years, India has practiced what everybody else has practiced. It's not difficult to try and understand what has happened, because you are the model. Anything that you guys have done, we will do. We are firmly wedded to your ideals. A lot of Americans don't seem to be aware of it from a brief tour around your country of very, very high rates of farmers' suicides in the US Midwest, which have been on since the 1980s. And really, what is it? I mean, it's the collapse of smallholder farming in the face of the assault of agribusiness. The last figure I saw for your smallholder farms was 700,000 in 2006, according to the Associated Press, going bust at a rate of 160 a week. In any case, you have nearly three times the number of people you have in prison than in farms. That's your equation between family farms. Actually, after coming to the US, I learned the word family farm. In India, every farm is a family farm. It's because you have 90-95% of your farming cornered by the gorillas that you have to use the word family farm to demarcate it. Worldwide, seven or eight processes have been in flow for the last 25-30 years in the West, in India for 15 to 20 years. The first, we don't have the time, so I'm very crudely summarizing them. The first would be the withdrawal of the state from sectors that matter to poor people. The second is the rapid transfer of wealth from poor to rich, the United States being a wonderful example, and the post-meltdown period being an even greater example. You know, according to the United Nations, it costs $60 to $80 billion additional expenditure to solve the basic problems, to tackle the basic problems of the human race. $15 billion additional expenditure on education sends every child in the planet to school. Likewise, they've got numbers for sanitation, hunger, etc., which they've been putting out for 30 years. I add up the menu, it comes to between $60 to $80 billion, but governments have never implemented this, saying, where's the money? Show me the money. When Wall Street hits the fan, the governments that could not find $60 to $80 billion for 30 years found $1 trillion inside of a month, and subsequently found a few trillion dollars more in cooperation with their friends in Europe. So the money is there, but who does the money go to? Rapid transfer of resources from poor to rich. Third, the imposition of user costs and fees on people who can't afford it. Fourth and fifth, most critical, the privatization of just about everything, including intellect and soul. Five, the unprecedented rise of corporate power. So these are some of the processes. They're the same whether in the United States or in India. The impact in the poorer countries is far greater. I question the ridiculous idea that the meltdown started in September 2008, or that the recovery began in January 2010. The crisis that you talk about from September 2008 was plaguing 100 countries across the planet. It's when it hits the boys in the suits that it becomes a crisis. Okay? Other countries were suffering much worse, thanks to the same guys and the same kind of fund. Today in food, for instance, between 50 and 60% of all grain traded in the world's largest grain markets is controlled by hedge funds and index funds, most of them originating in this city. Okay. One of the things that your media did not tell you about, it mentions it off here and there in one-off sentences or maybe a good article in one of the alternative sites, the role of food prices in the Arab Street uprising, how major it was, how serious it was, incredibly serious. The FAO recording its highest ever food price index increase of 32% in 2010. Did they even tell you about this in any detail? No, it was Google and Twitter that done it. So in India, huge withdrawals took place from agriculture, shifted it to middle class and upper middle class consumption. Second, the banks withdrew from the countryside. There's a closure of thousands of banks in the countryside branches, moving, just like in Australia, by the way, moving towards middle and upper middle class urban consumption, like mine, for instance. Third, the agricultural market is thrown open to market-based pricing, which means you can charge anything you want. Cultivation costs go up 500% in the case of cotton in a space of 7 years, between 2003 and 2011 in Vidarbha, which is the worst affected region. So the farmers' costs explode, the farmers' income collapses. Right? There are many other, there are other complicated factors in this. The chief being the withdrawal of credit and the prices, and the fact crucial to this hunger and why the food has gone down, we shifted millions and millions of farmers from growing food crop to growing cash crop in the classic World Bank IMF menu of advice that, why are you guys growing food? What will you do with food? Eat it. Grow hard, grow cash crops, export it, gain hard currency, be rich. That's what we did. The difference between India and Latin America is that it wasn't, nobody sat in the World Bank and IMF who could force it on us. We embraced it. By the way, all our top officials are former World Bank IMF officials, including the Prime Minister and the head of the Planning Commission. They get pensions from there. I mean, I'm saying it's the mindset. They think that's the way to go. They believe that's the way to go. They're believers. Now, removal of credit from the countryside leads to a doubling of debt in the peasantry. And that is the single largest factor driving the suicides. Every suicide has a multiplicity of factors. But when you've got a quarter of a million of them, you want to look for some common issues. Debt is the overarching principle that you can see. According to the government of India, 26% of Indian farm households were in debt in 91, 48.6 in 2001. We don't know the 2011 figure yet, but it's been doubling. So you have a farming, agriculture is anyway the most disadvantaged section. It explodes under these policies. And there's much more to say on that. I don't have the time. So I'm just going to tell you one little thing about how easy it is for the elite to disconnect themselves from what's going on. And it's not new. It's very easy for us to shut ourselves off from what's going on. In 1857, if you look at the newspapers of 1857, they actually reported famines and things. They still did some reporting. 1857 was the year that Queen Victoria got tired of being a queen. And she had acquired a fairly large space of real estate. We call it India. And she decided to call herself Empress of India and hold the biggest party in human history, in modern history, certainly. It was called the Darbar of Delhi, at which 68,000 guests of royalty, origin, most of them royalty, paid obeisance to the new empress of their land. The Darbar lasted for a week with 68,000 guests. Yeah, they had more than 2,000 cooks, and then they had, I guess they had cooks to cook for the cooks. Then they had the guests were royalty. They came with their whole entourage. By the way, you know, and in the same period, in the 1 week the Darbar lasted, 140,000 people died of raging famine in between Madras and Mysore alone. Now, if you look at the newspapers of that period, the famines are reported, the deaths are reported. They report barricades of the cities where policemen are clubbing peasants to death as they try desperately to enter the cities for food. All this is reported. And the Darbar is reported with pomp and grandeur. The connection is not made. Today, there's no connection to make because we don't report the first part at all. We just report the pomp and the grandeur, right? Much less of the, if you look, the only book in, the only historian, many histories mention both. They mention the famine of 1876, they mention the Darbar. The only one making the connection in, that I have seen, is Mike Davis's book, Late Victorian Holocaust, which actually makes the connection. Otherwise, it's one of history's secrets. Call it Victoria's Secret. Thank you.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.